Blog Talk Radio.
Hot stove and autumn evening to all you Metsian folk out there. This is Sam Maxwell, and you are here with the Metsian Podcast, and we are so thankful that you are. Please like and subscribe on Apple, Spotify, YouTube, all the likes. We appreciate that. So without further ado, coming at you live from the tri-state, we will go right to our featured guest who's going to help us break down the latest Mets news, which, of course, is yet another new manager. And he's the editor-in-chief of The Wave. He is the founder of Gotham Baseball, and he has been on this podcast plenty of times, and that is the Mark C. Healy. How you doing, Mark?
Thanks, Sam. I appreciate you having me on.
I'll tell you, the most memorable managerial or really off season for me, which was technically before I officially became a Mets fan, but I remember crowding around my college internet screen and watching first Willie Randolph be hired and then Pedro Martinez come and then Carlos Beltran come. And the excitement around those at the time was fervent. And thinking about how many of these I've gone through now, I'm pretty numb to it all. So with Carlos Mendoza now the official newest manager of the New York Mets, and you remind me what number this makes for the franchise, your first impressions and really, I guess let's, you know, obviously start broad, and then I kind of want to get into the weeds about this entire thing, how it came into fruition.
Well, Carlos is the 25th manager in Mets history. And, you know, I began this offseason, once it became clear Buck was out, and I had a feeling it was going to happen, not because I felt that Buck deserved to be fired. I'm a Buck guy. I love Buck Showalter. But I just had a feeling with David Stearns coming on board, he was going to want his own guy. Unlike a lot of other people who are convinced it was going to be Craig Counsell, you know, I just felt like regardless of what happens, David Stern is going to want his own guy. We've been dying for president of baseball operations with his kind of resume. And to bring somebody in there, you just, you know, regardless of what's right, what's fair, you just had to feel that he was going to bring in his own guy, number one. Number two, I said at the outset, I said, look, I don't want a novice. I don't want a first-year manager. You know, there's plenty of people out there that have managed that, you know, would be a great fit. You know, but I also use the caveat that if they wanted to go internally with somebody like Eric Chavez, you know, or somebody intriguing like a Joe McEwing or somebody of that nature, I'd be open to it just because of the connection to the Mets and, you know, my personal interactions with some of those people that were being talked about or at least were on Mets fans lists. I talked about John Gibbons as a guy who, you know, I've always admired and I really have a lot of respect for. And so, you know, I did have the caveat that it would have to be somebody intriguing. You know, that's the first thing. When it became clear that David Stearns wasn't necessarily looking for somebody like that, and it made no sense. Like, you know, some people say, oh, Ron Washington. I love Ron Washington, but you don't fire Buck Showalter to bring in Ron Washington, you know. Some people were like Joe Maddon. Again, you don't fire Buck Showalter to bring in a Joe Maddon. It wasn't going to make sense. To me, he was going to go younger. He was going to go with someone that was more like, you know, a collaborator, a partner, that type of guy. Then Carlos Mendoza is one of the candidates. And I didn't even take his name seriously when I first heard it. I was like, well, you know, they're just, you know, maybe they're just, you know, making sure that they're hiring, that they're interviewing a minority candidate, which I am in favor of, because that's how guys get jobs. You know, you go through enough interviews and you get good, you know, good feedback, and you can write about how well this guy did in an interview, and that gets him more interviews, and then, you know, eventually gets a job. And I'm a big believer in that. But then when it became like he was a finalist, I don't know if you saw the tweet, but it was a weekend where every single team I root for lost from like Friday to Sunday. You know, it was the Knicks lost, the Islanders lost, Notre Dame lost, the Falcons lost, my NFL team, the Atlanta Falcons. And I said, the way my weekend is going, Carlos Mendoza will be named manager tomorrow. And that's exactly what happened, you know. And, you know, and again, like I said, you know, Sam, I was perplexed. I wasn't disappointed, because once he was a finalist, I knew it was a possibility. And I knew, I felt from the outset that Craig Counsell, and I wrote this, so this is something I wrote it. I wrote that Craig Counsell, to me, was always a 50-50 shot because of the proximity of where he lived with the situation with his family. And I also said that if he's coming here just for the money, I don't want him. I don't want somebody here just because they're getting the most money. I don't want that. I want, you know, somebody who wants to be here. And I always, and again, like I said, I don't love Craig Counsell, but I liked the idea because of the pre-existing relationship with David Stearns. The fact that they were successful despite that Stearns didn't hire him. It was Doug Melvin that hired him. And Stearns inherited him, and they wound up working very well together for like 6 years. But then, you know, Mendoza gets the job, as I said, perplexed. And then, you know, like what is it, like an hour later, the Chicago Cubs, with a manager who's already under contract, hire, you know, Counsell before firing David Ross. And, you know, to me it was like, well, you know, I mean, that they gave him a big contract. He wanted to stay where he was, but he didn't want to stay with Milwaukee. He went to Chicago. And I hate the Cubs, so, you know, that's perfect. You know, now just another reason to hate the Cubs. But one thing I promised myself, Sam, was that I was going to do some due diligence on Carlos Mendoza. And I really didn't know anything about him other than the fact that he was the best coach for the Yankees. No, that's never going to stop me from liking or disliking someone. You know, I covered the Yankee system, and I covered the Yankees for a while. And so I just reached out to a bunch of people I know in the Yankee system and people who I trust, who I know will tell me the truth, whether it's good or whether it's, you know, like, oof, you know, you got a rough guy there. Not one had anything other than he's going to be awesome, that he's that type of guy, you're going to love him. And I was like, well, we'll see, you know. And then I saw the press conference. And I loved it. I'm not like that. You know, I didn't like Mickey Callaway's press conference. I was happy with Mickey Callaway, but that's because he wasn't Terry Collins. But when Mickey Callaway was talking about how he was going to love everyone, and that was ironic because that's kind of what happened. But, you know, I just absolutely loved that he wasn't this polished robot. I loved that this was this passionate guy who showed a lot of emotion, that he, to me, said some really interesting things. And, I mean, look, it's obviously a wait and see, but I'm confident that this guy, you know, let's put it this way. Is he going to be Bobby Valentine? Is he going to be Davey Johnson? I have no idea. But I like what I heard from people I trust, and now having seen him with the press conference, I saw enough where he wasn't like this prepared guy. What he was like a broadcaster, where he, you know, he said everything we wanted to hear. He just seemed like a human being that loves baseball, And, you know, I kind of am willing to give him the benefit of the doubt.
I agree. I mean, so, you know, I've basically been waiting my entire life for a new manager to latch on and go the distance with this team, you know. And every time, whether it be, let's say, let's just go from the 2010s, whether it be Mickey Callaway, Louis Rojas, Buck Showalter doesn't exactly count, but you see what I'm saying? Like, there have been these moments where a manager could have latched on. Willie Randolph is even a perfect example, coming over from the Yankees as well. So he probably should have been given the best chance to have led the team through thick and thin without, you know, knee-jerk reactions, which is, of course, has something to do with the, you know, the former owners. So, like, at what point, and this is obviously what we're hoping, does somebody who is new, young, latch on for this team finally?
Well, I think that with David Stearns, you know, this is a guy that definitely has a blueprint in mind. And he only had one manager the whole time he was in Milwaukee. And he came from, you know, he worked in organizations that have been successful. And, you know, when you talk about the Cardinals and you talk about the Astros, you know, teams that have, excuse me, you talk about teams that have continuity, that have, you know, consistent programs in place. And I think that's what he's trying to build here. And he's looking for a manager that can grow with him. You know what I'm saying? Now, you know, to me, you know, it's some people will look at it like, oh, he picked a guy that he could tell stuff, you know, tell him to do stuff. And because he's a first-year guy, he's just going to have to say, yes, sir, may I have another, you know. And that's a cynical way to look at it. It's not completely out of the realm of possibility that could be the case. But I don't get that sense from Stearns that he is a, you know, Billy Epler telling Buck Showalter to play, you know, Daniel Vogelbach every day. I don't get that he's that type of, you know, front office executive. I think he wanted someone whose baseball acumen that he would respect and give him a seat at the table in the decision-making process. And I guess how the coaches are selected, how the coaching staff is selected, will give us a little bit of a window into that decision-making process. But I really think, to just go with what, you know, the statement and question that you made about a first-year hire getting that ability to grow, you know, getting that ability to, you know, get the chance that Davey Johnson did. But again, you know, people will say, well, Davey was great. Yeah, but Davey came up through the system. You know, Bobby Valentine failed miserably in Texas, but he came up through the Mets system. So he did know a lot of the players that he took over when he took over for Dallas Green. You know, guys have been successful in those kinds of, you know, people forget Gil Hodges was a manager before he came to the Mets. He was the manager of the Senators, and he was pretty successful. Obviously, it was Washington, so he wasn't that successful, but he had, you know, he made impressions upon people that he would be able to lead a team, you know. But, I mean, look, I'm just not feeling anything negative. I did not want Willie Randolph to be the manager of the Mets in 2005. I was totally against it because I knew he wasn't Omar Minaya's first choice, and that all full autonomy nonsense, you know, went through the window. As soon as I heard it was Willie, I was like, well, you know, so much for you know, full autonomy. And again,
can you remind me who his first choice
tell people,
was?
Well, his first, if you remember correctly, there was a couple of different managers that were candidates that were interviewed, and the guy that Oh, my God, his name escapes me, and he was the hitting coach for Texas. Oh, my God, I'm having a senior moment here, Sam.
I wouldn't remember.
I'll remember it probably when we're done.
Either.
but he was the hitting – huh? Say it again.
No, I just said I wouldn't even remember.
I can't remember. You know, I'm going to kick myself after this interview is over. He was the hitting coach for Texas, and he was very popular in Texas. He was a guy that Omar Minaya and, you know, Omar's mentor Sandy Johnson had a lot of respect for, and that's who Omar Minaya wanted to be the manager. And it was a situation where the Wilpons felt that because he didn't have, you know, a perfect command of the English language, that he was going to be someone that would struggle with the media, and, you know, the compromise candidate was Willie Randolph. And, you know, and again, like, it wasn't like I was so against the idea of Willie Randolph because he was a Yankee. I didn't really care about that as much as I had been around the Yankees a little bit at that point, and I just had a feeling that he would be a little bit too uptight and sensitive to criticism.
Can I tell you who I think you're talking about?
Who?
Rudy Jaramillo.
Yes, Rudy Jaramillo. Thank you. Rudy Jaramillo, that was the guy. Oh, my God. Well, everybody will mock me for my senior moment.
Hey, Rudy, I wouldn't remember that name either. I wasn't really paying attention to the Texas Rangers at the time.
No, but you know how many times I've said it in interviews? I think I even talked about it on your podcast before with the other guys, talking about Rudy Jaramillo.
Let's give a shout out to our partners in crime here at the Mets Scene Podcast, Rich Farrago and Michael Collant, who could not join us tonight. But thank you for reminding me, Mark.
Maybe they heard I was going to be on, and they were like, "Absolutely not! Are we appearing, Mark Healy?" It's very possible.
No, I think it's Kevin,
I take it personal.
You know, the various things other than you.
The point I'm trying to make is the last time I was really, really happy, before Buck Showalter, the last time I was really, really happy with a manager hire was Bobby Valentine. You know, that was the last guy I was really, really excited about because I wanted Bobby to be the manager for so long. And, you know, he was just a guy that I admired from the time when I was a kid, when I met him at a Xaverian High School father-son dinner. And, you know, he was just the greatest guy and the nicest guy. And he was such a baseball – and everybody in Texas hated him, so that meant I knew I was going to like him, you know. But, you know, so –
he's the bubblegum champion of 1978.
That's right. But the point I'm trying to make, Sam, is that I know a lot of people are dumping on this choice. They think he's going to be Louis Rojas 2.0. And people forget Louis Rojas was only hired to be the manager because Beltran was let go at the last minute. You know, like that came out of nowhere. And so they had to scramble and hire somebody. And with Jeff Wilpon, Brody Van Wagenen running the show, they figured they'd just grab some guy from the system. And you know, they weren't expected to win. You know, he was just kind of like a bookmark until they could, you know. And then, you know, Sandy loved him because Sandy Alderson was a guy that loved to, you know, he doesn't even care about who the manager is. And that's why Louis was kept into place. You know, and look, I love Louis, you know, I think I really, really liked him. I thought he was a great guy and I thought he knew his baseball, but I think he was just overmatched. And that's the problem with front offices that don't take that into account. Like, this is New York, man. It ain't Milwaukee. It's not some other place. Whoever manages the team has to be able to deal with the huge amount of media every single day. And do I think that Carlos Mendoza is going to be up to it? Well, we're going to find out. I got the kind of feeling watching his press conference that he may not be, you know, he may not be as funny as Buck Showalter. He might not be as, you know, polished as maybe, you know, Aaron Boone. But I think you're gonna get someone who is driven, who loves this game, and is going to be honest with the fans, because that's what, when a manager talks before and after games, he's not talking to the media; he's talking to us through the media.
Right.
So people are concerned, about that aspect of the job. To me, I feel like after watching that press conference, I'm definitely not perplexed anymore. And, you know, I kind of feel good. Like, I kind of like want to root for this guy, you know, and I'm going to give him, you know, especially depending on what kind of roster he gets, you know, I'm certainly going to be willing to give him the benefit of the doubt, you know, for the foreseeable future.
And I think this is a good segue, because I kind of want to look at, in terms of Steve Cohen's big picture. And, you know, I've had a podcast since afterwards, so I'm pretty sure talked about David Stearns with Greg Prince and Lauren from Queens, who was on the last podcast, but I didn't even think about it in terms of, now that we've seen this managerial hire, I didn't think of it in terms of this full long-term plan that obviously Steve Cohen was thinking about the moment that he got here. And when you look at the decisions that he made for those first years, there are a lot of stopgaps that you see, which is why there's 2 out of 3 losing seasons, because he's trying to form his own identity. And he had been waiting for David Stearns. He kept saying, I want to wait for my guy, and he couldn't even use the name out loud. But we all knew who he was talking about, and he got his guy, a local guy, who has had very good success in the modern age within that NL Central. And when you really look at it, both in terms of the managerial hire, with somebody coming over from the Yankees, which is a whole other element that we need to talk about in terms of how long he was with the Yankees and his preparedness for New York. But it seems that after kind of, you know, a lot of bumps in the road, which really, when you think about it, was going to happen, but on all accounts, he is running this corporation extremely much better than the people that came before it, just from what I've heard, and it, I believe, from what you've heard. So when you really think about, you know, obviously now we have to talk about the possibility for this hot stove, but I think from the bigger picture Steve Cohen era thing, I do see what is happening.
I think that Steve Cohen knows what he's doing. I think that Steve, you'll hear less and less from Steve, because now he's got somebody to run the whole shebang, baseball-wise. And I think they will eventually hire a team president that will just deal with the business stuff. You know, David won't be involved in that. David will be, you know, David won't be reporting to him. But, you know, Steve wanted somebody, and you know, I guess he didn't feel Billy could run the whole show by himself, and Billy Epler, and, you know, certainly we don't know that investigation. They haven't announced what the findings are yet. Billy did the right thing by resigning. I was kind of looking forward to that partnership. I'm one of the people that like Billy Epler. And I think that circumstances were more of a situation than his, you know, whether he was good or not good at being the general manager. And, of course, you know, we can have a whole show about that and debate what he did and what he didn't do. I think what the Mets would be in much worse shape had they taken my advice and not dealt anyone at the deadline last year. You know what I'm saying? Like, I think that Steve Cohen paid the freight on all of those deals so that they could get back the best possible prospect return that they could. And now the Mets are in much better position than they were a year ago. Now, fine, the team, you know, obviously the regular season was awful. We all expected, you know, a World Series appearance, you know, if not a World Series championship. I certainly was very high on the 2023 Mets and was very down on the 2022 Mets after the sweep in Atlanta and then losing to the Padres. And so, right. You know, I, you know, getting Verlander, I was like, you know, we're going to the World Series. And between the injuries and the inconsistencies and the, you know, just complete lack of depth in the system and everything kind of coming to fruition, the Wilpons probably would not have, you know, the Wilpons probably would not have done what Steve Cohen did prior, yep. You know, by dealing David Robertson and then, the dominoes falling. And even if they did, they certainly wouldn't have paid the freight. And we've seen 1,000 different examples of the Mets playing the bait and switch. You know, or we saw that 1,000,000 times. So for anyone to compare anything that's happened in the Cohen era to, you know, the Wilpon era, they're just people who are miserable and negative. And I'm not saying, look, I'm no pom-pom waver. I think everybody knows that. You know, I may be a journalist who's a fan, but I am not a pom-pom waver. I have no problem, no qualms criticizing anyone for anything. And so, to me, now Steve can just sign the checks. I mean, I don't know if there was a reason that was given why he wasn't at the press conference, to introduce Carlos Mendoza. But I thought it was brilliant.
I think you're right.
I thought it was a brilliant decision.
It's Stern's
show. I hope it was on purpose. Yeah, I hope it was on purpose because, you know, there were times last year, there were times when Sandy was still on board as the team president the team president, when he would do it, you know, they would do an interview and Billy Epler and was like, why is Sandy here? Let Billy answer the questions. Like, why does Sandy have to be here? You know,
I just didn't like the way Billy spoke, you know?
Well, Billy came, you know, Billy was, you know, and that was the one thing I didn't like because Billy doesn't always speak that way. And, you know, when I knew him, when he worked in the scouting department with the Yankees, and that's how I would explain to people. So, look, I like the guy. I met him when he was, you know, in the Yankees, system, and he was a great guy, nice guy, you know, polite, a gentleman. And when you're a gentleman in this sport, you know, like Omar Minaya was or is, you know, you gravitate towards those people and you're willing to kind of deal with them on a human level. Yes, of course, you are. They have to be accountable for the mistakes that they make. But you also are dealing with someone that, you know on a personal level. Not that I'm willing to cut him slack, but, you know, there's no rage. There's no viciousness when you're discussing the pros and cons of somebody's work product. Billy's problem, like a lot of people in baseball, think that they are giving a seminar, at a Mensa convention, or they're talking about assets and just like, please stop. Like, there's only a portion of the fan base that thinks like that. The rest of us are, you know, want to know. Like, even when I would ask Billy about guys and their, you know, what they're doing with runners in scoring position, and then he would talk about like probabilities, and I'm like, oh my god, like, don't you get that people don't like that?
Cashman does it too. People want the analytics to be a part of the game, but not be the game. That's the bottom line. I think that's
like we don't,
what
right,
outdated
right, exactly.
Of
we don't need to hear what your conversations are behind the curtain. Just like how they have to translate it for the players. You know?
Right.
Like, come on. I mean, you know, like players are, you know, the athletes, they're very few and far between where they're like Mike Mussina, really, really smart guys. I mean, a lot of these guys are, you know, they're athletes. They're not those scholars. So they need the data to be translated for them. So when you're giving a press conference, just talk about, you know, he's swinging the bat really good, or, you know, we love the velocity, but we're not happy with the location. I mean, you know, try to – you don't have to dumb it down, but don't, you know, we know what we're looking at. You know, we know what we're looking at. When you lose 7-1, we don't want to hear about, you know, like, well, the guys are really battling in the zone, you know, come on. Like, we don't want to hear that. And I think the analytics guys, you know, sometimes don't get that. Like, they don't understand that, you know, that not everybody wants to, you know, follow the game with an abacus. You know what I'm saying? So, I thought Billy, and I criticized Billy for that too a couple of times in columns. And I said, well, I like Billy. You know, try to understand who you're speaking to.
Right.
When you're, you know, the suit speak, you know, that corporate jargon, it doesn't always fly.
See, I think Sandy did that a lot, but I think what Sandy benefited from was this dry sense of humor that crept up on you. And I like that about Sandy. You know, regardless of how flawed his time here was, he also did a lot of things, including take us to a World Series that we should have won. So, you know, he set us up for success. And unfortunately, the Mets bugaboo was the failure. But, you know, we don't need to go down that rabbit hole necessarily. Before I reset the show, you are listening to the Metsian podcast, and usually around this time, we ask our guest, and today is Mark C. Healy, to give us his shameless plug. And, Mark, also, there's potentially some people out there that have never heard you, so give us your Metsian roots as well as your shameless plug.
Coming up, the shameless plug is coming up is the Queens Baseball Convention, December 2nd at the Four Points in Flushing. I will be hosting the State of the Mets panel, which it leads off the QBC each and every year since its existence. I'm the only original panel host left, I believe, in the 14 years that I've been doing it. And I'm excited this year. We're going to have Anthony Rivera from the Subway to Shea podcast is on the panel for the first time. And Tim Ryder is joining us again from Simply Amazing podcast and the Apple blog. And for the first time ever, John Mincone is going to be joining us. He's the founder of Brella Sports and a former minor league Mets pitching prospect who has been, you know, working with, you know, does a lot of private lessons and those things. And he's founded Brella Sports, so he's going to be on the panel. Really excited about it. Hopefully, you know, it's right before the beginning of the winter meetings. So hopefully we'll have a lot to talk about. And again, it's at the it's at the Four Points in Flushing. It is a great, great venue. We did it there last year. The special guests this year are Cliff Floyd, Billy Wagner, and Terry Collins. So really excited about that. My dad, who looks just like Terry Collins, but we'll hopefully get the first Terry Collins / Terry Collins doppelganger photo in the history. I'm really hoping
that's gonna be great.
That done. And of course, you know, my book came out in 2020, perfect timing, of course. My book, Gotham Baseball, New York's All-Time Team, came out April 6, 2020, right in the thick of COVID. So I had to cancel almost every signing event for like a year and a half.
Right.
But thankfully, people have been great, though. You know, people have been great, and the book's done well, and I'm really happy, and I'm in the process of putting together my next book project. And folks can follow me at Mark C. Healy on Twitter. Mark C. Healy, M-A-R-K-C-H-E-A-L-E-Y. And I became a Mets fan in 1975. Tom C. was my favorite player. And, you know, I've been a fan since 75. I've been covering the Mets since 1996 for a variety of media outlets. And, you know, people say I'm, you know, my friends and the colleagues say I'm too much of a fan to be a journalist. And the fans think I'm too much of a journalist to be a fan. So, I, you know, I'm always, I always tell people, you know, this is who I am, and the last thing you're ever going to get from me is a platitude or BS. You know, I'm always going to shoot straight. And, you know, so it's up to you whether or not, you know, like you like it, either you like it or you don't. But nothing that comes out of my mouth is ever going to be a prevarication or, you know, some kind of made-up bullshit for, you know, clickbait. I don't do that. You know, it's just not what I do. So, some people like it, some people don't, but that's you know, I do what I do, Sam. You know what I'm saying? So I appreciate all the people that follow out there and that support, you know, me every day. And, you know, even the people who can't stand me, they make me laugh sometimes. You know, I'll like something outrageous they say. So, you know, you can't have a thin skin in this business, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And we appreciate everything you do, Mark. You know, the Queens Baseball Convention, it was so awesome when it's just born out of an inept franchise and their ownership.
Right.
And I give them money every month. I give them a few dollars every month. So, you know, I want to keep this thing, you know, pushing along. And I think that it is kind of, it is good. It's just thinking you're talking about you being the last one left from the first one on the panel. I think that's because those were all people that the Wilpons sent to try to spin what was going on with the am I correct, am I remembering this correctly?
No, I think that the guys were pretty independent, you know, from the beginning.
Okay.
The first one
there
ever,
was, I think there was a whole separate panel that had to do with like representatives within the offices of the Mets on the first one.
Oh, no. They've done that. The Mets, there's been, those are actually very popular panels, the Met executive panels, Meet the Met Executives.
Right.
The problem wasn't that previous ownership, you know, tried to, you know, well, maybe in like 2019 or 2018 when they had the,
their own one.
They finally decided to do their own. That they you know tried to sabotage the QBC. But I think for
are
the
you
most
gonna write
part
this
they just
book? Are you going to write the ultimate Wilpon book? Is that what's going to happen?
Well, that's one of the projects. I have two projects in the works right now. One's a Siever project and one's a Wilpon project. But you know, again, the Wilpon project has been in the works for a long time. And it's if I ever do get let's put it this way. I'm in George R.R. Martin territory with that Wilpon. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, just don't make
like,
you know,
like,
I guess
it's
the
like
10 years
season. In the making.
The
yeah,
2020
I don't
season
be that guy,
was as bad as season 8 of Game of Thrones, so you know, right?
Yeah, so you know, like we're still
great.
Waiting for the Winds of Winter. So that's the bet, you know, that's the bet I've made with some of my friends because we're big Lord of the Rings, Game of Thrones guys.
Oh.
And, you know, we're fans of the books. I mean, I've read the books like 3 times. So I tell people, I say, look, I'll tell you what, I'll make a bet. If Winds of Winter comes out before this Wilpon book, the Mets are going to win a World Series. You know, like that's kind of how it works. But the problem with the Wilpon book is that, you know, what people don't seem to understand is that people love Fred as much as they hate Jeff.
Right.
So no one's going to be more motivated because of their dislike of Jeff or distrust of Jeff and aren't as willing to criticize the Wilpon era. Even people that were completely screwed by them because they love Fred so much. And look, I'll say this, and I'll say that, and I've said it 1,000 times. I don't hate Fred, and I don't hate Jeff. I didn't really have a relationship with Fred at all outside of maybe 2 or 3 conversations. I had a little bit more of a relationship with Jeff, and I was a supporter of Jeff for a long time until, you know, until I learned about what was really going on. And, you know, what I learned over the years. And, you know, so for me, the motivation isn't about this tell-all, I hate the Wilpons kind of, you know, book. It's just to educate people, younger fans who have no recollection, no concept of what that era was like. And a lot of them are on Twitter right now saying that, oh, this is just, you know, Steve Cohen is just like the Wilpons. You have no idea what you're talking about, like not even a little bit. So that would be the motivation for that book. You know, that would be the motivation for writing that book. And that's why it's so difficult, because it has to be done in a way where it doesn't look like it's I hate Jeff book, because it's just
right.
So much more nuance and so much more. It's important that the book has to be written that way. You know what I'm saying? So
I think you could probably think about it. You could probably also like think about it with Mover and Shaker, the Walter O'Malley biography, because I think that is a very even field. Nobody hates this guy type book in many ways.
Well, I've read so much of them. I haven't read that one, Mover and Shaker one. Who wrote that?
Give me a second.
I haven't read that one. Because my favorite book about
Andy McHugh.
Whole era. Yeah, I have not read that. I have to check that out. My favorite book is called After Many a Summer by, I believe it, his name is Robert Murphy.
Yeah, I saw him. That's a great book. I saw him at the library when he
Yeah, and in the
that.
Book,
at,
and in the book,
public,
and I,
the
you know, I
library.
Talk, in my book, I talk about it. He, you know, he makes the case that it was all Walter O'Malley's fault and not Robert Moses. But in the book itself, he kind of, like when you read it, it's so well done. You're like, wait a minute. You're saying that, well, whatever. We're going off on a huge tangent. We'll probably do this. Anyway, the point I'm trying to make is people try to make Walter O'Malley the devil.
Podcast.
Yeah. People are trying to make, you know, like Fred Wilpon or Jeff Wilpon the villain. And in many cases, yes, they did create a dysfunctional situation, but it's more about not realizing that they were less part of the solution and more part of the problem.
Right.
You know, that they always thought of themselves as savvy baseball people when they really had no business putting together a roster or being involved in baseball operations at all.
Exactly. And speaking of baseball operations.
You know, Steve – Look, and Steve, let's put it this way. If Fred Wilpon had a couple of pops and got on the phone with Steve Boris and signed Carlos Correa to some ridiculous contract, right, and then leaked it or, like, got it reported, and there is no way that he would have allowed Steve Phillips or Jim Duquette or Omar Minaya to then not sign the deal.
Right.
Like, that tells you the kind of guy Steve Cohen is, that he met, you know, he negotiated with the player, you know, then he gave it to the baseball department. Then the baseball department said, you know what, can't do it. The medicals don't match up. Can't do it. There's no way Fred Wilpon would have allowed that. You know what I'm saying? And so when people talk about, you know, the way Cohen operates, like, just that's the proof of the pudding. The fact that he hired David Stearns, that he's on the record as saying he doesn't want anybody learning on the job, but then he lets David Stearns hire Carlos Mendoza. You know what I'm saying? Like, there's no this isn't, you know, this isn't an owner who isn't going to allow his people to do what they need to do. Now, I think David Stern has to win pretty quickly. I don't think it's going to be acceptable if it, we have a repeat of the 2023 Mets in 2024. I don't think that's going to be acceptable. But, you know, I mean, this is a situation where you have an owner that is you know, committed to winning.
Yeah. And so what do you think David Stearns is going to do this offseason? Obviously, there's a lot of clickbait about Pete right now. But, you know, outside of, you know, that's included in all of this talk. Let's start broadly. You know, what do you think, how do you think David Stern's first winter is going to be as Mets president of baseball operations? And I believe the first one we've ever had, correct?
He's the first president of the baseball operations. He is the first. I think Sandy had the kind of autonomy under Steve Cohen that he never had under the Wilpons. So he had a certain amount of autonomy, you know, autonomy. I think Steve Cohen really trusted Sandy. I thought it was a terrible move by Steve to bring Sandy back. But, you know, look, we could have a whole show just on Sandy, you know, the pros, the cons, you know, because I'm not one of the, you know, I'm not a Sandy Alderson fan. I've said this 1,000 times, but I say that in a good way and in a bad way. Because I feel like, you know, Sandy is a mixed bag, you know. And, you know, you got a lot of good, you got a lot of bad. And, again, you have to remember who he was working for. And but then you also have to factor in some of the decisions he made when he was, the team president. So, you know, if you want to have a conversation about whether he's good or whether he's bad, make sure you include, you know, everything. And so this first winter that David Stearns is going to have, I don't think he's going to spend like a drunken sailor, and not because Steve Cohen's going to not let him. He has to build a team. You need at least – you need to figure out who's playing third base. You need to figure out who's playing second base. You need to figure out who's playing right field. You need to figure out who's playing left field. You definitely have to get some depth. Because you don't want Brandon Nimmo having to play 158 games, or however many games he played. He played too many games. Tommy Pham was not supposed to be an everyday outfielder. He's supposed to be a guy that was going to give depth in the outfield. You know, you need to figure out who your number two, number three, number four, number five starters are going to be. You need to fill up that bullpen. You know, and hopefully Edwin Diaz is healthy and ready to go opening day. Hopefully he's healthy and ready to go at the beginning of spring training, so that, you know, the plan of, you know, signing all these relievers that have options rather than, you know, getting, you know, three or four quality relievers. I mean, there's a ton that needs to be done. And we don't know where Starling Marte is in their plans. Obviously, the difference between one of the biggest differences between the 22 Mets and the 23 Mets was Starling Marte, who went from being one of their most valuable offensive players to a guy that he couldn't stay on the field and be healthy. And when he was a 240 hitter with very limited power. And all of a sudden became a defensive liability as opposed to being, you know, a very good defensive outfielder. So there's so much that needs to be done. I do think that we will see a very, very real effort to get Yamamoto. I think he's the number one target. I would love to get Otani, but I don't see it happening, not because the Mets aren't going to be willing to pony up for him. I think that Shohei Ohtani is going to sign with the Dodgers, and I really don't think he's going anywhere else. You know, again, that might come back to bite me in the ass, but I don't see Ohtani coming to the East Coast.
He's probably comfortable in the exact same city, he doesn't have to move. I mean, you know, especially with the money they can offer him, I think it does make a ton of sense.
I mean, could it happen? It possibly could happen, but I'm not, you know, again, you know, I don't think the Mets are going to unload all of their prospects to get Juan Soto. I think that Juan Soto is a guy I would love to have too, a guy who could, you know, hit behind Pete Alonso. I don't know if that's going to happen. I do think they will probably look to sign a guy like Jorge Soler, who I would love to see batting behind Pete. But I think a lot of the moves that people think they're going to make, you know, when Steve Cohen bought the Mets, a lot of people were like, oh, we're going to spend the most money and we're going to do this and we're going to do that. I don't think Steve's going to be like Fred where, oh, we spent money, that didn't work, let's just try to go with young players. I don't think that's going to happen. They have tickets they need to sell. You know, they got bills they got to pay. They are not going to want to feel they can't win 95 games. So
right.
I think there's going to be a big push to get Yamamoto. I do think they're going to try to go after a guy like Jorge Soler, a real, you know, left-handed or right-handed DH. Hopefully we'll find out tomorrow if they will non-tender Vogelbach. I don't think you could have the guy on the roster next season.
Oh,
I think
Jesus.
It would be like, you know. Well, you know, here's the thing. I kind of like Vogelbach. I don't dislike him.
I don't dislike him either.
But they force fed the guy on Buck. They force fed him on us, you know, the fans. And he just wasn't good enough. He wasn't good enough to be a guy. I don't want to hear about his OPS. The guy, having a guy like that walk when the guy behind him can't hit is the biggest nonsense that these people who preach OPS and on base percentage, you know, that only works when you have a productive offense, when you have guys that know how to get hits with runners in scoring position, that guys know how to make a productive out in that spot. When you have a bunch of guys who are free swingers, it doesn't really matter how much you walk. You know, of course it helps, you know, it helps the process of clogging the bases and making sure if you hit a three-run homer, and I get all that. I get all the physics and the analytics. I get all that. But at the end of the day, you need to score more runs than the other team. You need to, you know, it's not just a game-to-game-to-game basis. You've got to look at your season as a series of, you know, winning series, keeping your bullpen fresh, making sure that your starters are giving you enough length so that you don't have to kill the bullpen every night, and making sure that you have offensive players that know what they're doing in the batter's box. You know, the idea of Daniel Vogelbach, you know, treating his at-bats like he was Ricky Henderson. You know what I'm saying? You're not a good enough hitter to justify not being able to play a position, not being able to run, and not being able to hit your weight. So I think that David Stearns is going to have to be creative. I think Yamamoto is probably going to be always the only really big ticket item.
What do you think about the fact that I do believe Vogelbach was on a David Stearns roster at some point in recent?
Yeah, he was, but that doesn't mean anything. I mean, I think he traded for Vogelbach, but I think he also DFA'd him. I have to look that
too.
Up.
No, I think you're right. So
he was an all-star, I think, in Seattle. I mean, this is a guy that has had some success. But he just struggled. And, you know, it's like when a guy like Starling Marte struggles, you know, he's got such a track record of being excellent that you're willing to put up with the struggles. You're willing to put up with the fact that, that he was injured. You could say, well, he wasn't 100%. But can you really say that about Daniel Vogelbach? What did he finish hitting? 220? I mean, you know.
Yeah, something like that.
I just, to me, there are, that's not a hill to die on, Daniel Vogelbach. You know what I'm saying? So
yes, exactly.
You know, I'm just not.
Exactly.
I don't see how. You know, I just don't see the usefulness of a guy like that on the roster. I'm sorry.
I agree, and I'm sure that you can find somehow, some way, especially with all the youth coming up. I mean, at certain points, Mark Vientos was doing a great job down the stretch as the DH, or at least, you know, flipping between third base and the DH. And I think there could be some answers there. I mean, what do you think about the young guys? How do you think David Stearns is going to analyze and figure out what to do, whether that be on the roster or through trades? And I guess, yeah, what would you do with the DH spot?
Well, I would definitely try to fill that with like I said, a Jorge Soler. I mean, I would definitely try to get somebody that's a veteran that.
Is he generally at first base before?
I believe so. Maybe an outfielder.
Yeah, so
but,
that makes sense.
You know,
yeah, that makes sense.
I mean, obviously, it has to be somebody that can play, you know, that they don't clog up the DH position with somebody that can't play a position. So that if you need to move guys around, you're not losing bats. You know, if you want to give Francisco Alvarez some at-bats at DH, you know, I know we're stuck with, you know, Oscar Narvaez for another year, you know, which to me still I don't understand. I still think Thomas Nito is a better player than he is. But, you know, again, it's not up to us. You know, it's not up to us. We don't make the evaluations. The front office does. So you just hope that whatever mix that they put together, again, I've given up trying to identify players that I want the Mets to sign or to trade for because they don't listen. They don't listen to us. You know what I'm saying? I mean, are there guys that I would love to see on the Mets? Absolutely. You know, I would have at least two or three sidearmers in the bullpen if it was up to me. It's to me, I don't waste a lot of time. I look at two or three guys that I'd love to get. I really think that the biggest thing that this team needs to do is to fix the starting rotation. You can't rely on Tyler McGill. You can't. My favorite of all those guys. I happen to be a big David Peterson fan, and he's obviously not going to be available till July if he's available at all. Excuse me. After his surgery, I love Joey Lucchese. I love the way he pitches. Mm. And, you know, if he could stay healthy, he'd be great in that fifth hole. I like Carlos Quintana. I thought that, you know, that was a kind of a freak thing that happened with him. I thought he pitched pretty well.
Jose Quintana,
when
right?
Jose, what'd I say, Carlos? Jose Quintana. I think I did that on another podcast the other day, too. Jose Quintana. Thank you for correcting me. I liked what I saw out of him. Obviously, you know, Senga was tremendous, but you definitely need at least two more starting pitchers. And I would love for the Mets to add Yamamoto, and before he, you know, helped the Texas Rangers win the World Series, I would have loved to include Jordan Montgomery in that off-season plan, but he's gonna get paid big money. I don't want Aaron Nola at all, and I definitely don't want, you know, Blake Snell. I definitely do not want that guy and want no part of him. So, you know, I think that the Mets have to learn their lesson, and then they're better off having five quality starting pitchers than worrying about making it top heavy with older veteran pitchers, you know, older veterans that you know, you just can't build a rotation that way. You know, look at the Yankees. They signed Carlos Rodon to be the number two. He was awful. He was horrendous.
Absolutely terrible.
And almost every move Brian Cashman made for pitching in the last two or three years has been awful. And they had a guy in their own system, Jordan Montgomery, and they traded him away for Harrison Bader. And basically they traded him for nothing. You know, so pitching is to me the number one thing the Mets have to fix. The offense comes second. I think the young guys, as you touched on before, I like all of them. You know, I like Francisco Alvarez. I like Brett Beatty. I like Mark Vientos. I like what I've seen from all of them. I've loved what I've seen from, Mauricio. But again, you can't have that many young guys in the lineup if you're expecting to compete right away, especially when none of them showed that they were overly consistent. They had stretches where they were effective, and you had stretches where they, you know, excited us. But, you know, we need consistency from the young players. And that's why you can't have four or five of them in the starting lineup,
right,
you know, for 2024. You just can't. You have to be able to evaluate.
I'm the highest on Ronnie Mauricio. I just think this kid's going to be a stud.
No, I am too. I mean, I think they all have value. I think the trick is always, you know, I remember back in the day when the Cincinnati Reds had Barry Larkin and Curt Stillwell as young players trying to win the shortstop position. And I remember there was a guy in my circle that was a big Reds fan. And he was like, who do you like? Who do you think should? And I didn't really know the players except seeing the two of them play as kids, you know, as call-ups. And there was something about Curt Stillwell that I liked. So I followed that whole battle. And I was a little disappointed when Barry Larkin won that battle. Little did I know that Barry Larkin would become a Hall of Famer and Curt Stillwell was like basically a utility infielder for the rest of his career. So the ability to self-evaluate, the ability to figure out which of your young players to keep, which of them to keep as depth for, you know, organizational depth, and the ones that you can trade to get someone better, and the ones to say, okay, you know what, of these three guys, this is the guy that's going to be the everyday player, hopefully all-star. So that's the thing that David Stearns really has to figure out.
Well said. And before we go to our final word, just wanted to say you have been listening to the Metsian podcast, and we're so thankful that you do. And I also just want to, you know, give condolences out to the entire Padres community for the death of the owner, Peter Seidler. It's, you know, I had no idea that their owner had been battling cancer, but, you know, I'm, of course, you know, I'm not a Padres fan, so I'm not schooled on this, but Mark, if you could remind me, when did he purchase the Padres? And I'm guessing that he, you know, has a lot to do with not only the turnaround, but kind of the, like, finally they kind of have, you know, a brand identity, which they struggled back and forth to find for so many years.
Well, you know, he's the grandson of Walter O'Malley. I don't know if you knew that.
I did hear that during this entire part. Yeah,
he's the grandson of Walter O'Malley. So when they bought the team, there was a lot of people, and I want to say it was like 10 years ago, but I'm not positive. It's been a while. I would say probably about maybe 10, 15 years when they bought the team. And, you know, I remember because I used to write about the Padres when I was at Associated Press, so I had – and I have family in San Diego. And a lot of people weren't so happy because I don't know if you know this, but the San Diego Padres, they hate the Dodgers, like with a passion. Like that's a rivalry that maybe like not as celebrated as, you know, let's say the San Francisco Giants and the Los Angeles Dodgers. But the San Diego Padre fan base hates the Dodgers with every fiber of their being. So getting Walter O'Malley's grandson to buy the team, some people felt was you know, they weren't too happy about it, you know. But they really became, you know, he became the biggest Padre fan, you know, on the planet, and it showed in the way that he built the team. And so, you know, I don't know what's going to happen there, you know. I know that the whole family is very involved, and, you know, it's very sad. It's a very sad because Peter O'Malley, who I believe is his uncle, you know, is a guy that a very special guy as well. And I got to meet him and interview him. I have a lot of respect for Peter O'Malley. And, you know, so it's just very sad. It's just very sad. And to see, you know, they are struggling financially right now. They have to make a lot of decisions. And that franchise is in a very rough spot, and very sad to see the passing of a guy way too young at 63.
Way too young, and again, we send our condolences out there. Rest in peace, Peter Seidler. You know, it's just with darkness comes light, one way or another, you know, I hope he's somewhere out there, you know, playing baseball in the clouds. So before we go, I'll also follow this up, something earlier about Juan Soto. Do you think if the Yankees do trade for him, or anybody trades for him, that an extension is going to be included? Or I do believe Scott Boras is his agent, is the idea that you were trading for one-year rental?
I think it is. I do not see the Yankees giving him more money than Aaron Judge. I don't see that happening. They could, if they trade for him and he has a great season and Aaron Judge says, you know, fine, give him more money than me because he's younger than me and we can win a couple of World Series. I don't see, you know, I don't see where the Yankees have the prospects to get Juan Soto. And Juan Soto is not the guy who's really messing around with their payroll. You know, he's the most attractive, but he's not making the kind of money that's going to give them the kind of salary relief that they need. I don't see that as being. You know, could the Yankees get him? Sure, I guess they could get him, but I don't think even if, you know, they got them, even if the Mets got him, maybe the Mets would be the only team where he would sign an extension. Just because, you know, the word on the street is that he really wants to come to the Mets. You know what I'm saying? Like, I could see that being playing a factor. But I could see that, you know, I could see it with anybody. You know, a lot of people want to play for the Dodgers. A lot of people don't want to come to play in New York because they're afraid of the microscope. They're afraid of the spotlight. They're afraid of the criticism. They're afraid of the toxicity, you know. And I understand that. I also don't want somebody to come here just for the money. I want somebody who wants that spotlight, who wants to play in the glare, you know. I don't see Scott Boras. I don't see him signing for anything less than what he thinks if he becomes. I don't think there's any way he's giving anybody a hometown discount. So, you know, it's going to be whoever rolls the dice. It's got to be a team that has a very deep farm system, and that is not the New York Yankees or the New York Mets.
Well, it sounds like if that's
like
the
put
case,
it this way. You would have to give up Francisco Alvarez plus
right
in any deal to get Juan Soto. And if you're not willing to trade Francisco Alvarez.
So if the word on the street is that he really wants to come to the Mets eventually, it kind of doesn't make any sense to trade for him, because if the idea is that he would only sign an extension with the Mets, then you might as well, if he doesn't sign an extension with anybody else, and who knows exactly how this is all going to unfold, but I think it would be a no-brainer to see what you can do about the roster this year and then worry about Juan Soto later.
Yeah, I don't necessarily agree with that myself. I would go get him. If I could get him,
if I could
make a deal that made sense, I would do it. I would not wait. I don't believe
in
that. But
without Alvarez.
I don't believe in that. No, I would trade Alvarez to get Juan Soto.
Ooh.
I would.
No, I see. I think
I would.
Just,
I would
another
do
person
it. I would do it, Sam. You know why? Because as good as Francisco Alvarez could be, he's not Juan Soto. He's just not.
But he's also 20. So I think it's
no.
Just,
I get that.
I think
I get
he's
all
just
that.
Got
he's
all
a catcher.
The makings of a star.
He's a catcher. I mean, he's not going to play any other position. He's a catcher. And you know, he's not going to be a 300 hitter. You know, he's going to be a catcher that hits like 250, 260, hits 25 home runs, and is a really good defensive catcher. I don't think he's going to be anything more than that. I mean, could he be somebody who's a perennial all-star at catcher? Maybe. Maybe that's his ceiling. But Juan Soto is an established all-star MVP type of player that you cannot allow if you can make a deal where, you know, fine, I'm not saying I would do it tomorrow, but I would consider it. I would consider it
okay,
for Juan
so
Soto.
Okay, lightning round, who would you rather have, Juan Soto or Shohei Ohtani?
Ohtani. Not even close.
Not even close. Okay. Well, there you go.
Not even close. If I knew Ohtani was willing to come here, I would. Ohtani is a freak of nature. Even if he can't pitch, you know, he's just such a good offensive player.
Yeah, but he should be able to pitch within a year. So you know, we'll see how the dices roll this offseason. The diet rolls, excuse me.
I mean, I would love to get him.
Dice,
but if
plural?
I had a choice,
wait,
I would get him.
Dice is plural or die is plural?
I'm sorry, say that again?
Dice is plural or die is plural? If you roll the dice, right?
Oh, roll the dice. Did I say dices?
No, I did. I think I said dices.
Oh, okay.
Roll the dices.
All right.
Anyway.
That's all right.
Without further ado, we will go to our last word because obviously I'm getting a little delirious. How about that? Once more, this is the Metsian Podcast. Thank you so much for listening. And give us your last word, Mark. Mark C. Healy of The Wave and Gotham Baseball, thank you so much for joining us. And the last word and anything else that we might have missed that you wanted to bring up.
Not really. When I mentioned earlier about the coaching staff, I'm really interested in how this coaching staff is going to be filled out. I was so surprised about Carlos Mendoza bringing up Willie Randolph as a guy who had a lot of, who had such an effect on him. I know that, you know, people have reached out to Willie and Willie said that, of course, he'd be willing. Willie Randolph is a guest about all the things that we could talk about with Willie Randolph and what was done to him, and what our perception was of his tenure, what really happened behind the scenes during his tenure. I think it would be awesome if Carlos Mendoza was able to have a guy like Willie Randolph as his bench coach. And if that happens, and I'm not saying that's the only thing that would trigger this, but if that happens, that just goes to show you that David Stearns really does want to collaborate with his manager and not just tell his manager who's going to be on his coaching staff. Obviously, Jeremy Hefner is returning as the pitching coach. He's now survived. I think this is his third manager that he survived. So obviously the organization is very, very high on Hefner. But it's going to be interesting to see how they fill out that coaching staff.
I'll say I don't completely understand, considering that the pitching hasn't necessarily thrived under his tenure. at this point, especially. You know, he was very promising earlier on, but we've kind of seen both factions of the pitching, the starting and the relief, kind of like Drew Smith was very promising and under Hefner's tutelage has not really performed well. And in fact, it has performed devastatingly bad with the big hits.
I think here's the thing with Drew Smith. I think Drew Smith has the ability to be a really, really good 7th inning or 8th inning reliever. The problem isn't his stuff as much as it's how he was utilized last year and his pitch selection. I really think that he can be a very good pitcher, but I think that he was misused last year, and I think that he needs to – I like to put it this way. I think he can be harnessed. I really do. But I don't think that that
Hopefully.
Will – I think when they look at Hefner, it's not just about there's a lot of things involved with Hefner, with some of the pitching lab and all those different things that the Mets are trying to do with their organization as far as teaching these guys how to pitch. Hefner is very involved with that, and I think they really like the way that he – and I think the pitchers really like working with him. So I think that's a big part of it as well.
And we will see how it unfolds. And this is the Metsian podcast. Once more, thank you, Mark C. Healy, for joining us this evening and helping us break down all of what has happened, what has transpired so far this offseason. And all I could say, my final word is bring on the hot stove. We are now awards have been given out. It is time to see how the free agents fall, and I can't wait to get started. And even though today was in the mid-60s, I'm ready to bundle up and rub my hands right near the hot coal stove of yonder lore.
Absolutely.
So thank
can't
you
wait,
all
Sam.
For listening to the Metsian podcast. Me neither, Mark. Take care, have a good one, and be safe out there to all of you. Oh.